Good morning again. I have a confession to make, but before I make the confession, I want to just say, you know how last week I told you if I ever say anything up here that sounds a little weird to you or whatever, you can come talk to me? Well, I'm banning that from this. That does not apply to what I'm about to say right this second. I hope that, because this is a true confession, that you will show me the grace that you would expect me to show you if you confessed something to me. Also, please don't ever talk to me about my appearance. Here's the confession. I'm a little vain. This is a sermon illustration, but it's also true to life. I tried to put on a dress last Sunday that I had bought before Christmas, and I wore to my old church for Christmas Eve, and it looked great. And then last week, I could not zip it up. This is really dismaying. It's not that I think I'm all that, I just don't like reminders that I'm not. So then I went to the doctor for my annual physical this past week, and for the first time ever, he said, "Well, you're really healthy, but you should probably start working out again." Okay, so this is when I really wish that I believed what I'm about to tell you, which is that today's facet of glory is weight. If I believed that, I would feel super glorious right now. Anybody else with me on that? It is, though. In case you think I'm making this up, I'm going to tell you that the first seven chapters of the book of 1 Samuel, which is where our passage from today came from, are all about this play on words with the word weight and glory. In Hebrew, the word that we translate glory, kavod, means, and the word that we translate heavy, kaved, are almost the same. A rabbi that I know tells me that the Jewish concept of glory denotes honor, weightiness, and importance. So these two words get played off each other for seven chapters in the book of 1 Samuel, and then, and also the concepts around those two words, like weight or fullness or emptiness. And even without knowing Hebrew, which unfortunately I don't, we can pick up some of this play on words as we study this passage. We're going to look more closely at the passage that Katie read for us. We are going to kind of overview all of those seven chapters. But I recommend going back on your own time after this and reading those seven chapters for yourselves, and maybe writing down every time you see a word that is either glory or weight or full or empty or hungry or that kind of thing. All right. So I think what we will discover as we go through this study today is this glorious God of ours, who is, as our passage says, a rock. Speaking of rocks, for the past couple of weeks, we have been comparing glory, the concept of glory, to a diamond. One of the ways we assess the value of a diamond, as you know, is by weighing it. What's the measure of weight for a diamond? Carat, exactly. As Commodity Online, whatever that is, says, if other factors are equal, the more a stone weighs, the more valuable it will be. Our analogy still holds. A facet of glory is weight. We don't measure God or people in carats, of course. But even non-spiritually speaking and non-literally speaking, we sometimes do use weight in a positive context. If someone makes a really good argument that has a lot of substance behind it, we say that argument has weight. We probably don't hear too much of that kind of argument anymore. That's not the kind that you discover on Facebook very often. And we also don't discover always the kind of person in the public eye who might be described as weighty, someone with gravitas. I don't know if people even use that word anymore because we don't see it too much. But gravitas means some kind of distinction, honor, dignity, and it's related to the word gravity, as you can guess. So last week we talked about how glory is the essence of a thing. Glory is what a thing is. And we also talked, about how the more real, the more is a thing is, the more present it is. And I think we can see that weight kind of goes along with that. Kind of like Barb was talking about, the something is big, you feel its presence. Even on a negative plane, maybe, if you use the phrase, there's an elephant in the room, the reason we talk about it like that is because it's obviously it's not literal, there's not literally an elephant in the room, but something is going on, there's a dynamic that feels really present, that feels really weighty, maybe people don't want to talk about it. So these things all kind of go together. That is why they are facets of one thing, which is glory. Last week we also talked a little bit about how in a world where God's glory is sometimes hidden, and where humans try to be God, things are not always as they seem. So we tend to think that things that we can see or touch are more real, more present, more weighty, more delightful, those are all facets we've talked about already, than the things that we can't. And so we talked about the Israelites last week, and they made the golden calf to worship because they couldn't see God. But the glory of the golden calf, the essence of the golden calf, was gold. The essence, the glory of the one true God is love. We live in an upside-down world, and when God is present, when God comes into the picture, he flips everything actually back the way it's supposed to be, but because we're used to the other way, it feels upside down, it feels kind of chaotic and unexpected. Today, Katie read us a prayer that is also a song. It's a song by a mother who couldn't have kids after she had her first kid. Talk about overturning expectations. As we can see from her song, Hannah's story, and also the bigger story into which she bears her son, Samuel, is all about overturning expectations. You didn't expect weight to be a facet of glory, did you? The story is all about contrasts. It's all about the different ways that a person can gain weight. In 1 Samuel chapters 1 through 7, we have a pregnant, barren woman, a little boy who gets to talk to God, a dangerously overweight priest, and two young men who are full of themselves. Verse 5 of today's reading basically sums up, at least symbolically, everything in the seven chapters and everything we will talk about today. So keep it in front of your eyes and in the back of your mind as we continue. Those who were full hire themselves out for food, but those who were hungry are hungry no more. She who was barren has borne seven children, but she who has had many sons pines away. So, who's Hannah? Hannah was one of two wives of the same man. And let me just say right here, that situation never goes well. There is not one account in the Bible. God doesn't even have to say don't do it, because it never works out. The other wife in this situation here, Peninnah, already had loads of children, but Hannah was not able to have any. At the time, the distinct essence or glory of a woman was believed to be her ability to bear children. I might say, and you can challenge me on this afterwards, even as a woman, I am a woman who has never literally borne children, there might still be something to that. Men can't bear children. There is something distinct for women and their essence in this biological fact. And in this context, childbearing gave a woman presence in her society. It brought her delight, and it literally gave her weight. Katie, how are you feeling? When you read Hannah's story, you find a woman who knows who she is. She knows what her essence is, but she is deeply unhappy because she is unable to live her glory, and her rival, as the Bible calls Peninnah, mocks her incessantly for this. Hannah is so upset, she can't even eat. She is as empty as she could be. But the words of the prayer in chapter 2 are not the words of an empty person, are they? Hannah's first words of her song are, "My heart rejoices in the Lord. In the Lord my horn is lifted high. My mouth boasts over my enemies, for I delight in your deliverance." Hey, did you notice the word delight in there? What happened? Well, Hannah had a baby, for one thing. But I believe something else happened too. I believe that Hannah had an encounter with the glorious present God. God became present to her, and God gave her her weight. Because then she sings, "There is no one holy like the Lord. There was no one besides you. There is no rock like our God." Sure, it makes sense that she's thanking God for this baby because she was barren before this. But this song is a lot more about God than it is about the baby. And it's a lot more about general human experience than it is about pregnancy. She talks about eating and being hungry and life and death and armies and fighting and all kinds of stuff that is not just specific to a woman's situation. Hannah is recorded as praying earlier in this story too, by the way, in chapter 1. But that prayer she prays out of the bitterness of her soul. Hannah's approach is a good example to us. She goes to God in sorrow and in joy. What triggers her first prayer is a particularly difficult interaction with her rival wife and a sweet but kind of oblivious interaction with her husband. And so Hannah is looking for glory. Is that okay? Is it okay for a person to look for glory? I'm not going to lie. I don't really appreciate glory seekers very much. I struggle when people seem like their goal is to make themselves look good. I feel uncomfortable when people seem like they're trying to make themselves seem better than me. And I don't like promoting myself either, which is why I'm a little conflicted about Facebook, even though I use it all the time. And I'm a little inconsistent with it. And I felt kind of weird about posting a picture of that sign up there that has my name on it, but it's cool because that's never happened to me before. So I'm not a big fan of these people that are trying to promote themselves all the time. I don't know how you feel about it. But when people, most of the time, when people are seeking glory and acclaim for themselves, here's the thing. They're not really promoting themselves. They are promoting something that they're not, or they're exaggerating an aspect of themselves and downplaying everything else. And they're seeking their glory from other people or at the expense of other people. That's what Peninnah was doing. She was gloating at the fact that she could have lots of kids and Hannah was barren. Hannah, on the other hand, was seeking her glory, the fulfillment of her true self, not from her rival, not from Eli the priest, who, when he saw her praying so hard, thought she was drunk, not even from her husband. She was seeking glory straight from God. Remember how last week we said that a person's glory, a person's essence, is directly related to the glory or essence of the thing or the one that they are worshiping? Hannah is going straight to the source. In the end, though, it's not really about her seeking glory for herself at all. It's not really about the baby. She is just seeking to be filled and fulfilled by the only one who can truly make her who and what she is meant to be. She says in chapter 1, verse 11, "Lord Almighty, if you will only look on your servant's misery and remember me and not forget your servant, but give her a son, then I will give him to the Lord for all the days of his life." Whoa, that's a pretty big promise. This is not just about her. This is something about God. When she has that baby, she fulfills the vow, just as God fulfilled her and her relationship with her husband. Hannah has to have had a lot of trust in the weight of God's glory after that experience with God to fulfill that vow. She has to have really meant it when she sang, "There is no other rock like our God." She has to have really meant it too when she sang, as verse 3 has it, "For the Lord is a God who knows, and by him deeds are weighed. Even deeds are weighed. And the standard of measurement is not carats, but God himself. Glory is weighty and has substance. God used Hannah to foreshadow in her song what God was going to do in Israel and in the center of worship there through her boy Samuel. God, in effect, made Samuel the scale, and God was the weight, and what was being weighed was the deeds of the priestly family at the time. Only, did you notice that Hannah promised to give her firstborn to God? The only way she had of doing that was giving him to the very priestly family that needed reform. This takes a lot of trust in the glory, the essence, the love of God, because she has to have known they were not a nice family. The high priest at the time was a man named Eli. He was old. We don't know whether Eli was a bad man or just kind of ineffective, but we could guess, based on his reaction to seeing Hannah praying, that he didn't know what a close relationship with God looked like, because he did not recognize praying. He thought she was drunk. That tells us something about him. He also had two sons, and they were bad men. They tried to gain weight. They tried to gain their glory through food and sex. Right after Hannah's song, we learn that Eli's sons, Hophni and Phinehas, are abusing the sacrifices that God instituted back in Exodus. The sacrificial system was set up to help people get right with God, both through the confession of sin and the offering of thanksgiving for God's provision. Even though the people were required to make these sacrifices, and the priests were intended to receive a portion of the meat, some of the portion was actually meant to be totally burned up as an offering to God, completely gone, and most of it was supposed to be cooked for the family that was offering it to eat during the festival celebration at the tabernacle. These priests, Hophni and Phinehas, were taking the best portions of the meat for themselves before any of it had been offered to God and before any of the families had been able to eat it themselves. And it's clear that the families of the priests were participating in this because later we find out that Eli is so morbidly obese that he dies by his own weight. He falls. He has a shocking piece of news. He falls and he breaks his neck because, the Bible tells us, because he was so heavy. His weight, his kaved, kills him. These two guys, who we find out had wives of their own, also molested the women who came to help out at the tabernacle. Me too? Hashtag me too, anyone? Here are some more priests, just like the Sadducees in Jerusalem at the time of Jesus, just like Aaron making the golden calf, taking advantage of the people and taking false glory, kaved instead of kavod, for themselves. Their deeds, as Hannah foreshadows in her prayer, are about to be weighed. By the end of the seven chapters, Eli is dead, Hophni and Phinehas are dead, and because they cared more about themselves than the glory, the delight, the essence, the love, the presence, the weight, and the substance of God, the Ark of the Covenant, which represented the glory of God to the people, has been captured. God uses Samuel to get it back to Israel, but it doesn't return to the center of worship until many decades later, after Samuel's gone, actually. So what's the point? So far, we've had three sermons about glory, and in all three, the priests are the bad guys. So it's probably a good thing that I told you a few weeks ago that when I preach to myself too, because with two that I know of exceptions, I'm the only clergy person in the room. So maybe the sermon is just for me and you guys don't have to listen. Obviously, I wouldn't be right. What do you need this information for, though? Well, I would like to acknowledge that there are specific guidelines and warnings in both the New and the Old Testaments about what the characteristics of the leaders of God's people should be. I take these guidelines and warnings seriously. I also want to acknowledge that even the New Testament assumes that some individuals will be set aside as leaders for the people of God. But the New Testament also tells us that all of the people of God are priests. All of them. If you belong to Jesus Christ, if you have, like Hannah, thrown yourself on God's mercy and love, and if you have promised to follow Jesus and glorify him, then you are a priest too. We are all priests. A priest is someone who reflects the glory of a deity to the world and who mediates between that deity and the people. If you belong to Jesus, who is our great high priest, it is your responsibility as well as my responsibility to contemplate the Lord's glory, like our theme verse says, and be transformed by it, reflecting the glory to the world. The Apostle Peter says in 1 Peter 2, 5-10, "You also, like living stones, are being built into a spiritual house to be a holy priesthood, offering spiritual sacrifices acceptable to God through Jesus Christ. For in Scripture it says, 'See, I lay a stone in Zion.'" Remember the rock? Remember the diamond? He is talking about Jesus. If God is a rock, then Jesus is the hewn cornerstone, and we are to look like him, living stones. "See, I lay a stone in Zion, a chosen and precious cornerstone, and the one who trusts in him will never be put to shame. Now to you who believe," he says, "this stone is precious. But to those who do not believe, the stone the builders rejected has become the cornerstone, and a stone that causes people to stumble and a rock that makes them fall. They stumble because they disobey the message, which is also what they were destined for. But you are a chosen people, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, God's special possession, that you may declare the praises of him who called you out of darkness into his wonderful light. Once you were not a people, but now you are the people of God. Once you had not received mercy, but now you have received mercy." We who follow Jesus are all priests. We didn't used to be priests. We used to get our weight, our substance, our identity in the world from other things, empty religion like all the priests we've been reading about, or money, or politics, or sex, or food, or our families, or a relationship, or alcohol, or drugs, or our career, or you name it. None of these things, whether good or bad in themselves, will ever give us our true weight and substance and identity. But when we line up with Jesus, the cornerstone of the church, we are priests. Let us be transformed priests, not like Aaron when he made the golden calf, not like Eli and his sons, slaves to food and sex, not like the Sadducees of Jesus' day, just in it for the money. We are God's special possession, that you may declare the praises of him who called you out of darkness into his wonderful light. This morning we are partaking together of the only one who can truly satisfy us and fill us, Jesus Christ, the bread of life, whose blood was poured out and cleanses us from all our sins. It's no accident that Jesus used the symbols of the bread and the wine, of food and drink, to symbolize the type of relationship he wants to have with us. He wants us to take him into ourselves so that he is fully a part of us. He wants us to gain weight, the weight of delight, presence, love, the weight of glory from him alone. Amen.